Treason, sedition, rebellion. This is the heritage of the American patriot. Those revolutionaries who stood on principle to fight against tyranny no matter the cost. And that spirit lives strong today in the activists and freedom fighters who fight against the authoritarian state. Each in their own way, each with their own mission, united for the cause.
I had the idea to run on a platform of fuck the police prior to actually winning the primary.
I mean, AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
They said, you don't get to tell us no, we're in the state health department, and I said, hell no.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
People already pushing back in ways that didn't even need any votes to be cast.
I'm not ratting on anybody, and I did what I did, so you're going to have to give me what the law says you have to give me.
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies and raise them to not be stupid.
Hope I don't get canceled. Talk to you.
These are the people whose stories I'm here to share. I'm Justin O'Donnell, and this is Submersive.
Man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists, anarchists, shitposters, and you people of the internet, thanks for tuning in and joining me for Subversive 86. Tonight's probably another short one, solo by myself, and as always, I'm Justin O'Donnell. But before we get started, just remember whatever platform you listen on, whether it's YouTube, Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, or on the air at LRN.fm, you can help grow the show by liking, commenting, subscribing, and most of all, sharing with your friends. If you enjoy the content, make sure to join the insurgency over on patreon.com/O'Donnell. Again, that's patreon.com/O'Donnell. And make sure to check out our sponsor, snackswag.com, for all your favorite merch, some favorite official podcast merch, rogue campaign merch, just irreverent campaigns and funny shirts, and where you can wear your principles on your sleeves every day of the week with snackswag.com. So make sure to head over and get some of your favorite threads so you can literally wear your messaging on your sleeves. And if you want to keep in touch between shows, follow me on social media and join our community Discord channel where you can keep in touch with other fans of the show and chat at any time with other people who listen and other people who want to promote it, and join our Facebook groups as well. All of those links and descriptions are available in the description of the video or podcast that you are listening to. So make sure to check them out and head on over today. Now, big news, we're also making a movie. For those of you tuning in and aren't aware, we're making a movie. Live Free and Thrive, 101 Reasons Why Liberty Lives in New Hampshire. A brand new documentary talking about how the freedom culture in New Hampshire, the libertarian culture in New Hampshire, and the greatest and most successful intentional community and migration movement is libertarians in history. Brand new documentary titled Live Free and Thrive, 101 Reasons Why Liberty Lives in New Hampshire. We're about to get underway and start production soon. So if you want to learn all about what libertarians have accomplished in making New Hampshire the freest state in the country, and in the meantime, head on over to the GoFundMe.com/101reasons to chip into production today. We are off to a great start in the first 2 days of our fundraising campaign to get this film produced, funded, and out there for free so people like you can have all the information you need when making your decision to move to New Hampshire. And why is it you should move to New Hampshire? That's a real big question. You're a libertarian. You enjoy liberty. You understand the ethics, values, and morals of libertarianism. You live them in your life. It's not just a political philosophy. It's a moral code to someone like you. So why should you? You've dedicated all this time, energy, effort, and work to the Libertarian Party in your respective states or other liberty movements in your respective homes to try for years and fail. Well, if you're not familiar with the Free State Project, I want to talk a little bit tonight about its founding. For those of you who aren't aware, I'm kind of in the mood of revisiting things and updating them and seeing how things have held up over time lately. I recently finished writing a new book called Get It or Not, Live Free or Thrive, 101 Reasons, based on a work that was done about 10 years ago when somebody wrote a list of the 101 reasons why New Hampshire was the freest state in the country. And I took it and updated it, changed some things because things have changed over the past 10 years. In fact, there's reasons now that are way better reasons to consider New Hampshire one of the most free states in the country that weren't a thing 10 years ago, because it took till now for free staters to make those things happen. And they're very important to consider that our goals and our ideas change over time. So when we talk about the history of the Free State Project, we need to go all the way back to 2001. In 2001, Jason Sorens, a graduate student, wrote a paper about the history of libertarian politics in the United States and how it was replete with decades of failures and waning momentum. And in his discussion of what political progress the Libertarian Party hadn't made in his first 30 years, he came to an immediate and obvious conclusion. None. None at all. No meaningful sustained electoral success and a continued lack of relevance at the national stage in politics, but consistently topping out at 3-4% in state elections. A recipe for failure at best and an argument for a diagnosis of insanity at worst. Doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting different results is the definition of insanity, after all. Well, perhaps we're past due for a revisiting of his work to see if it still holds up. Did his predictions hold true? Do his criticisms from 21 years ago still hold up today? Has the Libertarian Party taken any effort to overcome the criticisms levied 21 years ago? If you haven't read Soren's essay, I suggest you do. If you stick around, we're gonna review it line by line and go over it tonight. It's short, it's thorough, it's direct. It's not a heavy read, but its ramifications are profound for those whose lives are embroiled in the political fight for liberty. Now, when I say it's not a long read, I mean it. It's not that long of a read. But we're going to run down it together, me and you. And since an announcement of the Free State Project, published in the Libertarian Enterprise, July 23rd, 2001. Let's secede. What a tagline. How is that held up today? The announcement of the Free State Project. Now, Jason has added a note after publishing this to update it from the past. This article was the first exploration of the idea of a free state strategy, and needless to say, the present day Free State Project differs from the proposals in the article in some respects. In particular, the article does overemphasize the possibility of secession. Nevertheless, I think it's still of historical interest. That's from Jason Sorens, the author of this article, 3 years after the fact. I don't think that note holds up because I think the possibility of secession is now more relevant than it ever was, largely in thanks to free staters here in New Hampshire who've followed his writings and carried out the work he proposed. But let's get started. Libertarian activists need to face a somber reality. Nothing is working. Nothing. Partisan politics has clearly failed. Libertarian presidential candidates consistently failed to break the 1% barrier. While no libertarian candidate has ever won election to federal office. What's the chance that a libertarian presidential candidate will get even 5% of the presidential vote in, say, the next 20 years? Virtually zero. In hindsight, it was zero. Since 2001 to now, no libertarian presidential candidate has even gotten 5%. The closest was Gary Johnson, who topped out around a little over 3%. I'd be willing to bet the farm on that. And what about the chance that libertarians will take over the presidency, Congress, and the Supreme Court and enact their entire program? One would have to be utterly delusional to consider this a possibility so long as the United States political system exists in its current form. Noting the massive failures of partisan politics, some activists have argued that what we need is education. Unfortunately, the successes of education have come and gone. In academia, free market ideas, though even then not radical libertarian ones, were fresh and exciting in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Today, there's a backlash against libertarian ideas, caricatured as neoliberalism in all disciplines. The note that libertarian ideas could have backlash and be considered neoliberal by any stroke of the imagination is asinine and fantastic looking back on this 20 years ago. And then again, 20 years ago, far before my involvement, far before most people's involvement, in 2001, this was written before 9/11. That's a sombering reality. This paper was originally written prior to 1911, prior to the Patriot Act, prior to the TSA, prior to the largest growth of government in modern history, prior to the United States government taking the leap from oppressive to tyrannical that we've seen in our lifetimes. And back then, the Libertarian Party couldn't gain traction. And since, despite all the efforts of the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian movement, the government has continued to grow in size and scope. But political scientists view neoclassical economics as politically naive. While even economists have become bored with perfect market models and have gone back to thinking up new exceptions to the rule. In response to this argument, Chris Thieme of the British Libertarian Alliance believes that we should take a very long-run view. The victory of liberty will take centuries to complete, and we should not be hasty to abandon the project of remaking intellectual and popular culture. There are several problems with this view. First, it is very depressing for those of you who would like to see some measure of freedom in our lifetimes. Second, what is to prevent the welfare state from winning in the long run? It has the advantage of fulfilling the interests of elites in government. Reinstating freedom would require repeated large sacrifices by these people. Since people act in self-interest most of the time, the most sensible prediction is that the elites will never give up their power. Rather, they will reinforce it whenever possible. Third, the long-run perspective ignores the fact that world affairs are currently at the cusp of a new direction. Freedom can still win out, at least in some areas, but if it does not the prospects are dire. It didn't. Again, he wrote this prior to 9/11, June 2001, prior to the world changing so fundamentally where freedom was crushed under the boot of the state once and for all, almost, until we fought back. One doesn't have to see black helicopters everywhere to note the ad hoc world governance structures are already in place. Well, unfortunately, we see the black helicopters everywhere now. We live in a police state with security theater. NATO, the OSCE, the practice of economic sanctions, and UN peacekeeping are just a few institutions and policies that effectively prevent nominally independent countries from pursuing policies that conflict with any substantial fashion from the will of Washington, D.C., the globalist empire of Washington. It's true. The OECD is currently pursuing measures to punish the so-called tax havens. Their low tax rates are draining capital from Western welfare states, and their welfare states want to cut off the spigot. The proposed method of extortion is familiar: economic sanctions. The vaunted benefits of capital mobility and encryption technology thus have failed to materialize, and governments continue to grow, even relative to the private economy. The implication should be clear. If we do not carve out a sphere for freedom now, freedom will be lost for a long time to come. Can't be more true. It's odd that he predicted the response to 9/11 as just the inevitable growth of government with no knowledge that 9/11 would happen. But some individuals have noted the hopelessness of both mass-based party politics and mass-based education. They have advocated instead the creation of a new libertarian nation. These ideas have tended to be on the fringe of the libertarian movement simply due to their impracticality, not to mention their fraudulent nature of many of them. They invariably are run by one or two decidedly eccentric individuals who ask for substantial investments so they can start work on the infrastructure, typically of some floating island. I have to note that I think the Otto Rhodes project is legitimate. But there are not many American libertarians. I know who would be willing to move to Somalia. That number may be growing, Dr. Sorens. What we need is a libertarian project that we can undertake right here in the U.S. It's interesting. He mentioned seasteading as an option. Seasteading is something that was done. The Awal Roads Project in Somalia as other options that people were trying. As far back as 2001, people were trying to find their freedom away from the U.S. government. Some activism of this sort has been tried, involving monkey wrenching a la Claire Wolf, dropping out, not using government services, aka agorism. I'm still a huge stand for agorism. The problem with these strategies is that, one, they are small scale and unlikely to make a noticeable difference. True. Two, the more radical projects require abandoning family and friends and leading a lone wolf lifestyle. True. 3, refraining from using government services in many cases hurts us financially and helps them by making it cheaper for them to provide government services. Not a way I'd consider doing it nowadays. And that's kind of the exact opposite approach. Like, Ayn Rand talked an awful lot about Social Security and why Ayn Rand was willing to accept Social Security benefits, even as a objectivist libertarian who didn't agree with government and welfare services. And the idea is you've paid so much in, you'll never get that much back out. Take what you want, milk the system for what they already stole from you. And then there's the collapsitarian approach where the U.S. government will never be able to give us freedom and we'll never be able to grip freedom from the U.S. government. So we collapse the U.S. government, use its services to depletion. Both of those fly in the face of what Jason says here, but that doesn't detract from his point because it requires an adoption of those philosophies. I would like to propose a solution based both on my dissertation research and suggestions from my commentators whom I respect. Secession, or at least the threat of it. Walter Williams recently wrote in the World Net Daily, "Americans who wish to live free have two options. We can resist, fight and risk bloodshed to force America's tyrants to respect our liberties and human rights, or we can seek a peaceful resolution of our irreconcilable differences by separating. That can be done by peopling several states, say Texas and Louisiana, controlling their legislatures, and then issuing a unilateral declaration of independence just as the founders did in 1776. Other well-known libertarians have been advocating similar measures. The pro-secession views of LouRockwell.com and the Ludwig von Mises Institute are well known. Jim Barron told me he advocates peopling New Zealand with libertarians and making it into a libertarian country. Unfortunately, his immigration visa was denied for political reasons. Perhaps he will come to the U.S. and help us. What I propose is a free state project in which freedom-minded people of all stripes, libertarians, anarcho-capitalists, pacifists, even people who just call themselves liberals or conservatives, the only requirement is that you pledge you will work to reducing government, the minimal functions of protecting life, liberty, and property, establish residence in a small state, and take over the state government. I've been running some figures and see how plausible this strategy would be. There are about 40,000 paid Libertarian Party members. Pause. I don't have the number offhand, but I believe the actual number of dues-paying Libertarian Party members right now nationally is significantly lower than 40,000, or at least 40,000, less than 40,000 active donors. I may be wrong. I'm going to double-check. Don't quote me on this because I don't have it to reference right here, but 40,000 in 2001, no matter what the Libertarian Party's at right now, it hasn't grown in any substantial, meaningful, or mattering way. And the number of dedicated, freedom-minded people out there is undoubtedly at least twice that. In the last election, the Libertarian Party won 3.2 million unique votes, 400,000 for president, 80 for every LP member in the former case, 10 in the latter. If even half of the Libertarian Party membership moves to a particular state, we can expect 200,000 votes for the Libertarian Party presidential candidate just from that state. Furthermore, the Libertarian Party vote percentages are higher for state offices, typically on the order of 2 to 3% compared to 0.5% for president. If we multiply 200,000 by 4, we get 800,000 votes for governor and state legislature each. This figure is in excess of the need to take over some small states. For example, Wyoming, the smallest state in the union, there were 213,659 valid ballots cast in the 2000 U.S. Senate race. Of course, it's mathematically impossible to gain 800,000 votes in a state like Wyoming. But the point is that even 20,000 hardcore libertarian activists can go a long way in a small state. Once we've taken over the state government, we can slash state and local budgets, which make up a sizable portion of the tax and regulatory burden we face every day. Furthermore, we can eliminate substantial federal interference by refusing to take highway funds and the strings attached to them. Once we've accomplished these things, we can bargain with the national government over reducing the role of national government in our state, and we can use the threat of secession as leverage to do this. But didn't we fight a war over secession almost 150 years ago? Wouldn't the feds just send in the troops and crush our little experiment? The answer is, in short, no. In modern democratic countries, the use of violence against legal secessionist movements is out of the question. For example, no one advocates using force to prevent Quebec from leaving Canada if it so desires. The assumption underlying their recent referendum on secession was that if secession achieved a majority vote, negotiations would immediately begin towards a peaceful separation. The same holds for independence movements in Scotland, Wales, Flanders, Padania, Catalonia, and elsewhere. Indeed, the U.S. has militarily attacked countries for the way in which they treated separatist insurgencies. If the federal government tried to get Slobodan Milosevic on as Free Staters, how would that look? The key is that we need to pursue secession within a political system electorally. Attempting it extra-legally is a recipe for disaster, as the Republic of Texas fiasco has demonstrated. There is another advantage to the strategy of secession. It is a sort of stealth libertarian strategy. Most people have a lot of state pride. I used to live in Texas, and it was the general assumption amongst Texans that we could easily go at it alone and become independent. But we stayed in the U.S. merely out of a sense of graciousness and condescension. In other words, people might well vote for a general secessionist party, even if they wouldn't vote for an overtly libertarian party. Of course, once secession is achieved, libertarianism is the likely outcome, if we've concentrated our forces. Furthermore, independent small states are forced to follow relatively libertarian policies to remain economically viable. Even if we don't actually secede, we can force the federal government to compromise with us and grant us substantial liberties. Scotland and Quebec have both used the threat of secession to get large subsidies and concessions from their respective national governments. We could use our leverage for liberty. The strategy seems eminently workable within the next decade. The only difficulty is what game theorists refer to as a coordination problem. If I know that other libertarians will join me in moving to a certain state, it's in my best interest to move there too. But if I think others won't join me, I might as well stay where I have friends and good job. Everyone else thinks the same way and no one moves. For that reason, I think we do need a sort of formal organizational structure. We need a sort of pledge to which we can get freedom-minded people to sign their names, similar to the separation of school and state pledge, which would be a pledge to move to any state which is decided upon by a majority of the members of the Free State Society. The details of how the voting would ensue could be worked out. My current idea is that we would have a list of states with less than 1 million population. Once the Free State Society reaches 20,000, members would vote on these sequentially, with the lowest vote-getters being eliminated in each round, and votes would be made public each time to forestall fears of manipulation. Since, as libertarians, we respect contracts, we would rightfully feel duty-bound to honor our pledges. The coordination problem would be solved. Unfortunately, I am neither an organizer type nor a well-known libertarian personality. I'm an aspiring political scientist, a thinker. I don't know the first thing about leading, and my name doesn't have a cache. But if luminaries like perhaps Walter Williams and L. Neil Smith sign on to this project, and other motivated people join to help get along the legwork, we can really get this project off the ground. We have to start a snowball effect. It's exciting to me that we might have a real shot at true freedom in our lifetimes. Certainly, there will be inconveniences. We might have to move away from friends and family. There might be spells of unemployment. We might have to take careers that are not our first choice. But I can't believe that we've gone so soft that we won't tolerate these inconveniences for a possibility at attaining true liberty. Our forefathers bled and died because of a stamp tax. The Free State Project requires nothing of that kind. And the stakes are so much higher. How much is liberty worth to you? If you're interested in joining this project, please contact Jason Sorens. This is, like I said, from 2001. This is outdated, old, no longer really. It's still incredibly relevant, still very interesting and fascinating to consider how far we have come since Dr. Sorens wrote that letter. Following his call to action, a group of activists, along with himself, formed a new organization, drafted bylaws, drafted an online petition, and a pledge to move to New Hampshire once the petition reached 20,000 signers, with a mission to exert their fullest practical efforts to achieve liberty in their lifetimes. Those who signed the pledge and eventually moved to New Hampshire became known as Free Staters. And in February 2016, that goal of 20,000 signers was reached. The move was triggered. And although a great many of the had made the move ahead of time to lay the groundwork for the community, for the future of community and activism and politics of the libertarians to follow. Starting businesses, laying the foundations of community centers and community support networks, getting involved politically, running for office, the early Free Staters had a profound impact on the state, even in their small numbers. From initiatives for cannabis decriminalization to constitutional carry, to some of the country's most expansive school choice programs, the political successes of Free Staters have provided a stark contrast to the continued failure of political libertarianism on the national scale. And aside from topping the Cato Institute's Freedom in the 50 States Index as the freest state in the country, New Hampshire has also now become sort of a mecca for libertarian activists seeking friendly and welcoming communities where they can be surrounded by people who share their values. We have a new movers potluck where we welcome Free Staters who've moved from out of state every month on the first Tuesday of the month here in Manchester, New Hampshire. And every month there's a dozen or so people who they've just got here. New movers are constantly flowing in, constantly moving. And the craziest thing is most of them aren't those who signed the pledge 20 years ago. The snowball effect got real. And we have people who learn about the Free State Project and move a couple months later. And while libertarians in New Hampshire have been seeing these gains and successes, those in the other 49 states have continued to pursue failure in electoral politics time and time again. An unfathomable number of activists have burned out. An absurd amount of money has been wasted chasing the ever-elusive goal of ballot access for the Libertarian Party. This single fundamental hurdle, which keeps libertarians off the ballot, in and of itself, once achieved, does nothing to improve electoral results. As we see here, even 50 years later, libertarian candidates continue to strive and celebrate when they reach and break 3 to 4% in federal and statewide elections. Their accomplishments being meaningless at the end. In fact, getting a single state representative elected, Marshall Burt, in Wyoming 2 years ago, as a libertarian, that took the combined financial and manpower resources and the efforts and dedication of the entire Libertarian Party, its national committee, all of its staff, and all of its resources as dedicated and poured into its flagship Frontier program to campaign full-time on the ground with an unprecedented budget for a state rep race. Tens of thousands, though, they got 53%. Marshall Burt got elected. Fantastic. All the credit in the world to Marshall Burt. But Marshall Burt was running in a two-way race against an incumbent Democrat who didn't raise money, didn't run a campaign, didn't knock a single door, run a single ad, or even acknowledge that there was an election happening. And he still got 47% of that vote. In 2022, Burt is going to face a Republican challenge in a newly redistricted and gerrymandered district. How is he going to fare? That's anyone's guess. I don't know, and I can't predict. My guess is that it won't be well. But the fact that Burt's Democratic opponent in 2020 got 47% of the vote without campaigning, without raising a single dollar, without acknowledging that there was an election, simply based on the letter next to his name on the ballot, should be an indicator of why the strategy of partisan libertarianism is failing. Voters are stupid. Voters are uneducated, and they don't make any effort to inform themselves. Voters have no incentive to inform themselves either, as the truth is, the candidates that the major parties run accurately reflect the values and morals of the voter as far as the voter is concerned. People identify based on what political party they are registered with and align with, and that's who they vote for, no matter what the reality of the support or votes or history of that candidate may be. Politics in the United States, with direct representation and winner-take-all election systems, has devolved into a strong two-party system for most of the country's history. It's not anything new. And in any system where only a plurality is required to elect someone, you will inevitably see consolidation between two competitive entities. So it comes as no surprise that the United States has had such a strong two-party system that has only gotten stronger and more exclusive over the years. Add to that the advent of social media and the internet, which has brought people closer together than ever before. And with that closeness and interconnectedness has come division, anger, and controversy. The social costs of expressing a controversial opinion have diminished to zero because social networks are no longer limited by geography and personal connections, and cyberspace has become the new public square for outreach and debate. As people debate their ideas, they become more and more divided along them. And as politics has become more divisive, people have begun to publicly and socially identify with political parties instead of traditional identifiers such as national heritage, state of origin, community structures, clubs, sports teams, and elsewise. And with neither major political party actually representing a consensus of people, politics has become a fight for plurality control, with one minority oppressing all the others and forcing their viewpoints on them with the force of the state. So is it any wonder the libertarians continue to fail at trying to provide an alternative that people don't want? The destructive nature of partisan politics is the antithesis of the promise given to us by the American Republic. A government representative of the people for their varying different cultures and ways of life was promised and delivered with a warning. What form of government have you given us, Mr. Franklin? Well, a republic, if you can keep it. And that republic has been corrupted, bought, sold, transformed into a bureaucratic and pedantic nightmare that we know is the United States government today. So when you have an understanding that libertarian philosophy will forever be a fringe and minority philosophy and point of view, and a minority of people will ever embrace the values, ethics, and culture of liberty, what choice do we have but to abandon the false hope of democracy? What choice do we have but to abandon participation in a system that oppresses us at every turn? Concentration is our only option. Concentration is key, and only by coming together in a single geographic jurisdiction will libertarians concentrate enough of our collective influence to have an impact on the greater culture, and in effect, the legislature and politics that lie downstream from it within that jurisdiction. And thanks to Jason Sorens and his foresight as early as 2001, the Free State Project and the early movers who kickstarted the Migration for Liberty, that place is New Hampshire. Because in New Hampshire alone have libertarians garnered enough influence to be talked about openly in the news, to have our policies become law, and to see government dwindle and freedoms grow year after year. And we do so with a healthy disrespect for partisan politics. We don't waste time trying to fail repeatedly like libertarian activists and politicians in the other 49 states. Here, our partisan libertarian party does things with a purpose. They've taken a role within the greater movement that best suits them and best suits us and best suits the state of New Hampshire. They take up the mantle of outreach, growth, and public education. They take up the gauntlet to have the fights where they need to be had. They take up the burden of being the punching bag that opponents of liberty need so the rest can go unnoticed. But those who don the registration of whatever party is most popular in whatever district they live in, they take up the mantle of abusing the democratic system in favor of liberty and in the promotion of freedom. And that is the most honorable cause, the support of freedom and liberty in our lifetimes. Because you have to ask yourself, what is more important, being elected as a libertarian or being elected and enacting libertarianism? And that's a thought that everyone needs to rest with. Now, as I said before, you guys, I'm looking forward to bringing to you and to everyone else a brand new documentary film where we can discuss all of this at great length and in great detail. Live Free and Thrive, 101 Reasons Why Liberty Lives in New Hampshire, and so should you. And we need your help to crowdfund this new feature documentary. We do have producer slots available still for executive producers and producers, as well as recognizing all of our donors to this GoFundMe at GoFundMe.com/101Reasons. Again, that is GoFundMe.com/101Reasons. If you guys can check that out today, you can check out the poster, the banner, but the full description of the documentary that we're going to be running and the plan for distribution, how we're going to use this as a marketing tool to improve liberty in our lifetimes, not just for those in New Hampshire, but for those of you who aren't here yet, because you're coming. You just don't know it yet. And that's most important. And what matters most is helping us get this funded. We have a great first few days at the start of this weekend. So go ahead and check it out. GoFundMe.com. 101 Reasons. See how you can chip in today. You can be a part of the movement, a part of the mission, and a part of what we're doing next here in New Hampshire. Until then, and until next time, everybody, be free. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Subversive. Make sure to like, subscribe, and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live on YouTube. And make sure to leave some comments and reviews on whatever platform you listen on to let me know what you thought of this episode. And a huge thanks and shout out to our sponsors and the awesome members of the Insurgency on Patreon. If you enjoyed this content, you can join the Insurgency on Patreon by following the links in the description for patreon.com/O'Donnell. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, CastBox, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts every day. So until next time, everybody, be free.